This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 399 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. And this is like the penultimate episode before the 400th episode of the Outlander podcast. And we're in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Laura D. And remember, there's still some time. We have officially got our plane tickets to go to Scotland in May for Pod Abroad 2022. There is still time and there are still a few spots to join us. You can find out answers to all your questions, or you can always contact us, obviously. But you can find out the itinerary, where we're staying, the cities, the locations, the sites we're seeing, everything, and the prices, everything at podabroad.com.
This week, we will be continuing our episode discussion with episode 603 entitled Temperance.
We have no cold open this week, which is the first thus far. We go straight into the music. And I was like, there's not really anything to take notes of because I'm not paying attention to like whatever they switch out or change up. I'm not. However, since I chose not to fast forward through it, I just sat and listened while I probably played on my phone. And for some reason, actually, this is probably why I paid attention. For some reason, now this is the first screener that I ever remember this happening on.
Did you have closed captions?
Yes. What the heck happened?
Me too. I don't know, but I loved it. I loved every second of it.
I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. And so because I could hear really well and I was reading for the first time ever, like the closed captioning for the show, I was able to read all the lyrics. Now, not that I don't know the lyrics, but I was kind of following along. And I didn't, like, nothing hit me, nothing is new. But something that I really was like, holy dangy bop, that Griogare has got some kind of lungs. Like, I don't just mean for strength or volume. Yeah, okay, he can carry, he has an ear for music, and obviously he has a strong voice. But if you listen to their harmony, he's got a tenor in there. He goes up the octave. I was like, holy dang.
And so did you just then.
Sorry, I do that. So after we do go from the music, which is the normal opening, into the title card, which is a fireplace with a crackling fire and someone stoking the fire. Ha ha ha.
I didn't think stoking. I just saw a poker being placed in the fire.
It was a poker, but a poker was stoking. What was he doing? That's called when you poke
something. He just set it in the fire. He just set it in the fire. He didn't poke the fire.
I thought they moved it around. Didn't just set it. We open up on outside. Baby Henri Christian is in a basket floating down the river/creek, whatever it is, with these little boys, like, running down, like, following him. I'm like, seriously? Those little numpkins. Like, Roger takes off, hears him crying, screaming, whatever, goes off, saves the day. Here's my problem with this, besides the fact of that the boys did this to the baby, right? One of the boys, because they're all running along
is,
the bank.
Is the to, brother?
Like, well, no, that's not great either. But that's not the biggest problem I have. Or that's the biggest problem. A sub problem is one of the boys has the gall to cry out, oh no, the waterfall. Like, bitch, what the fuck did you think is expected to happen when you put a basket of something and let it go down the current? You're suddenly worried. And yes, I'm going to bleep myself. You're suddenly worried that this baby in a basket might get hurt?
Ginger, they don't think that far ahead.
I know that. I know that, Summer.
It's a child, and the children don't think that far ahead. They just think, let's see if it floats, and then the river picks it up. They don't think about the current. They're not thinking about that. They don't think about any of that until
it's too late.
It happens.
We all float down here is what they were thinking.
Okay, Pennywise.
So anyway, I was just thinking, it's a little bit too late to be concerned now, doofuses, whatever the plural is. But yes, of course, they're kids, whatever. Roger comes up out of the river holding the baby. So they're like, oh my gosh, the basket, the waterfall.
The very CGI'd basket went over the waterfall. They showed that for sure.
Yes. And so you're freaking out going, okay, the baby's gone. But Roger comes up out of the water like a some kind of, I don't know, Viking god, whatever, holding the baby, and he's soaking wet. So they said, the boys said that he was floating, meaning he and the basket did not sink, because he was the devil's seed, because that was the test they were doing. Because what they heard was that if you put a baby in the water, if it floats, it's because I don't think they went into this depth, but if you've, you know, studied history and the witch trials and the witch testing of the witch and everything, one of the trials or the tests is if the water rejects the thing, the baby, the woman, whatever, if the water rejects it, meaning they float, what people used to say that meant was that they were a witch, or they were a demon, or they were a devil spawn, whatever. And so if they sank, the witch or the baby or whatever, and they died, well, too bad, so sad, but they're innocent. So the only way basically you could be innocent was by freaking dying. So yeah, this is all great, right? So Roger, hello, Mr. Historian. He knows about this. He's obviously not going to, he's not there to like educate them on history. He's there to like, at this moment, he's like, this is not, he gets after them. But the most important thing is number one, saving the baby. Number two, doing his utmost to prevent anything like this from happening again. And so also, thankfully, Diana Gabaldon and Stars plays right into his, hopefully, maybe, story arc at some point. So Roger, after he comes out and says, thank you, little twerps, he baptizes that baby right then and right there.
They were running away. He's like, don't you go anywhere.
And he's like, after he got it done, he's like, look, the baby belongs to the Lord. This is enough. And as they run, and then they scatter. And he's like, Germain, you are not getting away with anything. You are not getting away with this.
I feel like Germain was not scared enough of his parents to let his friends do this.
Fair. Okay, let's look on that for 2 seconds. And I mean, really, maybe 10 seconds. His mom has 87 children and a brand new baby. And his dad is a drunk who is not there a lot. So they're not, and I am blaming Fergus. I'm not blaming Marcy. She does everything. She keeps that family together to the extent that they are, but she is busy. Now, I just say that, yet she wasn't attending the child. So who knows?
Right.
I know that I'm not blaming her because, you know, she has to go pee at some point too.
Well, you have an understanding of when you have a small baby that if they're sleeping, they're not going anywhere.
Right?
Little did she know that her very walking, talking son had other ideas. And you would never see that coming. You just can't imagine that as a parent of your kid doing something so horrible.
So shame, Marsley and fam. With them, Fergus is not happy, but he's not really expressing himself. Like, he's not talking about what's going on. So by the time Germain is there, she goes after Germain, and he explains that they were afraid to touch him. And Germain is reporting that these other kids were afraid to touch him. And Germain says he thought that if he complied with what these other kids were saying or taunting him with to do the test or whatever, like, if I comply, then, you know, maybe they'll leave us alone. They'll leave me alone. They'll leave Henri Christian alone. It'll all go away. So Roger says, Roger had taken him back home and the baby. So Roger says he'll have a talk with the kiddos. And by now, Fergus is bothered. He goes off in a huff. And then we see Jamie with him, and Jamie tells Germain to find his associates and bring them to the big house parlor to get their punishment. And Roger says he will go with him. Take that as to collect his associates.
He's like, I'll make sure he does it.
And then Claire, as I said, Fergus F's off. Claire goes after Fergus. That's right. Jamie and Claire had come to their house by this time. So Claire goes after Fergus. I got to say, I know I said it last time, but even more so this time, I'm so happy that Cesar has some meat this season.
Well, it's not just that he has some meat. I'm just glad he was patient enough to wait for this meaty season.
Thank you, sweet monkey.
That is,
yes.
That
I'm
is
so
more
glad
accurate
the actor because, stayed around.
Thank you, because he's been kind of, I mean, a job is a job. He's being paid well to do Fergus. I'm not saying that it wasn't worth it being in the other seasons of Outlander, but knowing that this season, if they could get the show to this season, he would have a large arc like this. Ugh. Thanks for sticking in there, Cesar.
All of it. So Fergus is worried. Claire says he's worried, of course, predominantly about Henri Christian. Now Claire says, like, don't we will protect him. Don't worry. But Fergus says, how will Henri Christian have a happy life? How do we know he'll be able to get married? How will he provide for a family? And I do appreciate that Claire's trying to be really, really positive and encouraging. Like, look, we will be there each step of the way to help figure out what we need to do. But you know, I'm with Fergus on this. Not and down in the dumps, but more of the realist here. I think I don't think Claire is being unrealistic. She's totally trying to say, we're here to help you. That's the truth. But Fergus is like, look,
you're not Claire, gonna live forever.
I actually know a thing or two about the lives of little people. At least what he observed while he was younger and staying in the brothel at Paris. And this whole thing, this and then later with Jamie was the most like heartbreaking part of this episode. He described to Claire what the maître des champignons, so the master of the mushrooms, right? And so the males, dwarf, little people, were called, there was a word I forget, but then the female were called les chanterelles. And so they were each, you know, they were protected because they were expensive. They were considered exotic, right? Of course, this all
they
means
were purchased
sexually.
From their parents. Like they were coveted to a degree, but they were not cared for.
So he explains this, and he says, "I knew a dwarf once. He didn't say his exact age, but he was young, just like Fergus was young. Because remember, all this had to happen before Fergus was like 10, because that's when Jamie got him. So there was a dwarf named Luke who was there, who was one of these champignons. And he found him one day, or saw him one day with his throat cut on the street, like in the, I think it's at the gutter, but I could be making that up. I think it was on the street outside.
It was an alley, I thought.
And he said what they did, not just to Luke, but to two dwarf little people, once they died, is that they would be cut up and their parts would be sold for divination. That's disgusting. That's disgusting. That's a disgusting treatment of any creature. But
unless he had a donor card.
Yeah, but you don't cut. No, not the same. So he's so happy. Well, he explains
to Claire. But think about
it. Claire,
this is the science of the time, right? Divination is like the science of the time. So you say, I donate my body to science. You could do that. This is their science.
Except that's not donation. Using the bodies of criminals to this is all about like a talisman. This is luck. This is to be able to have this part or a body part of a little person is such a rare. This is what I believe that they would believe is so rare and so hard to come by that they are prized not as humans, but as exotic sex toys, basically. And then once they die, they turn from one human being into maybe, I don't know, 100, 200, 500, who knows, little pieces that can be used for divination. So no, they're not treated any better in death than they are in life. Right. And he's so happy, he says, to have found Jamie and Claire. And he says he knows he'll never return to work in a brothel because he always has a home with them. He knows this. But he says, I'm worried my son will have no choice. He goes, you will not live forever, but the child will be a dwarf forever. And that's my fault. And this is where Claire can help and does help, even though he's not dense, but he's such in a fog of depression. And let's be honest, a man of the times, right? Not anti-science, but science is still new. Modern science is still new and is still being discovered. So genetic diseases or deformities or conditions like achondroplasia or different types of dwarfism, they don't know that it's genetic, right? When you see a baby that's born different and just before the baby was born or, you know, a little bit before the baby was born while the mom was still pregnant, they were attacked, right? So, of course, people of the time without knowledge of science make things up or, you know, there are not just superstitions, but they do the best with what they have. So he is having, not just because of the man of the time he is of, but also because of what has happened, right? He already feels a huge deficit as a man because of his hand and because of how little he feels he can do to feed his family and take care of his family and protect his family, especially with the whole attack. And then you add in a child who is different, right? The timing for him, there's no coincidence. So this is where Claire shines. When she's like, look, I'm a doctor. I'm a physician. If anyone knows this fact, it is me. His being a dwarf has absolutely nothing to do with anything anyone did. But he's just so, again, man of his time, but also very blinded by his depression and all and low feelings of self-worth. All of it are taking, like I said, he already had them, but it's taken an extra, not dump, but it's gotten lower, even lower. Next scene where Tom Christie, when Claire gets back to the big house, Tom Christie is there waiting. And she tells him about what happened with Henri Christian on the river. And she says kind of side-eyeing, kind of implying something without coming out and saying it directly. You weren't part of it, were you? And he gets a little uppity.
The kids that were with Germain were a lot of the fisher folk kids.
Oh, yeah.
So the assumption then that she's making is like they're hearing this from some people and, you know, probably their parents, but I hope this isn't something that you're involved with.
Yes, exactly. And he gets uppity and says, I am an educated man. I'm sorry that such a thing occurred. Is the child well? So at least he's not part of it. And he, you know, they have their own relationship going on. They're understanding. They're getting to know each other, whatever. Kind of a professional relationship, if you will. So he says, I'm here to have the surgery. My hand's better. Ready?
Wouldn't you love that if you'd be able to do that with a doctor? You just walk in.
Oh, girl.
You just have walk-in service for surgical things. Like, I'm here. I think it. And then he's like, it's been long enough. Meaning, you know, subtextually, I haven't beaten my kid enough recently.
Yes.
So could we get this done? Because I need to get back to beating my child.
And he refuses her offer of use of ether. And calls it one of her potions. And he calls it the devil's work. In comes Jamie. And she's like, has he always been like this? A masochist? And he's like, the who? The what?
What's that mean?
And she educates him on what that means. And then Jamie, to his credit, of course, tries to convince him. He's like, I've been through this stuff. And I did not have the option, sir. You do. I am telling you, please consider it strongly. And he's like, nope. Now I got to ask you this. I know what he did. The words he used were of a good purpose, right? He was literally like, look, I've been there, done that. I strongly suggest you consider it, right? So what he was saying and what he was doing.
That became a challenge.
Yes. That's my next question. So his intent or the what was, I think, good. Like, that's a good thing, trying to convince someone to, you know, take something so they don't have pain. That's not a bad thing. But
knowing the rivalry between the two, yeah.
If you look at what's going on and step back a second, I wrote more comparisons.
Yeah, it's all the measurements. But it was an unintended measurement. Like he wasn't trying
to. Tom Christie made it into a measurement.
Yeah. Because to Tom Christie, where Jamie is concerned, everything is a measurement. It has been since Ardsmuir. And in general, Jamie wins. Not because of his dick. I'm just saying in Ardsmuir because he was, you know, all of the men respected him and nobody treated Tom Christie the way they treated Jamie. And he brought everyone together and he envied him for that. So Tom Christie has his own sins. So like the sin of envy. But his need to be as good as or better than this man 100% did not work out in his favor.
No. So Roger goes out because it's time to like give them their little whatever. So Roger goes out to collect the littles to remind them about the meeting with, I wrote the Laird, but no, with Mr. Fraser. And while he's out, he hears Amy McCollum screaming. So he goes to see what's going on, and it's the frog in the milk scene from the book. Okay, so she had gotten some milk from Lizzie, or one of the boys had brought the milk from that Lizzie had. I almost said that Lizzie had pumped. That Lizzie had milked. but we don't know who did the frog, but it was likely one of the little boys. Amy, once he's found it and say, hey, chin up, it's all good. Amy like kind of collapses on the floor and she's in tears like, oh my goodness, my husband, I'm a widow and blah, blah, blah.
And Roger tries to talk to her and like say, chin up, my lass. It's going to be okay.
Is it going to be okay? If I hadn't just read Bees, I wouldn't have even thought about this scene at all.
Marsley is loving the spinning wheel that Bree and Evan Lindsay made. And some of the kiddos are fussing. And she refers to Jem's toy car, which we don't say, as vroom. And Marcy's like, why do you call it that? What does that mean? What is that going? And she's like, oh, that's the that's just the noise that Jemmy makes when he plays with it.
I mean, he does, but that's because Roger called it a vroom.
And then with Fergus and Marsley, Fergus promises her, or she says he promised her, that he'd stop drinking.
Mm-hmm. But he's missing.
Next scene, back to the surgery. Good Lord, Tom Christie. Such pride, I wrote. So his anesthesia is not ether. It is a little alcohol and the scriptures.
That he only took a very small sip of. Like he was like.
Exactly. Tipple, I was like, tipple. Dude, I have. This doesn't sound really mean. I have very little compassion for him. I do have empathy for the pain. But you effing chose this madness. But good on Jamie to take over the anesthetic scripture part. Did you notice who was in the background?
Yeah, she totally snuck up and was peeking through the window.
Little Miss Malva, looking through the window. Caught by Ian. So she says to Ian that she'd come by to ask Claire something. But she's like, they're busy. My dad doesn't want me to see him in pain, blah, blah, blah. And Ian says something to her and mentions, she's like, he's like, you're her apprentice, right? And she says, she called me apprentice? Aw. And Ian's like, well, let me walk you home. I wrote, obviously I'm wrong, but I wrote as I was watching, I wonder if this is when they boff off screen. But no, we accompany them all the way. He seems surprised. It worked. I got to figure out what I meant by that. Hold on.
The surgery. That was Christy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I thought we were still with
Ian. She just finished sewing his hand up. And then she showed him how they all stretched out.
Yeah. So he seems surprised. He's like, it worked. Like, dude, she doesn't lie about this. She doesn't lie, period. But she doesn't lie about this, about her talent. So she says, we need to have a slumber party so I can check you out later. And he's like, okay. So they do. And she does. Back with Ian and Malva. He's like, what's up with all this soul stuff? He's like, you're so young. Like, surely you haven't done much wrong. And she goes, Summer's going to love this. Summer's going to love all this episode. She goes, quote, looks can be deceiving.
She ain't even hiding it. The telegraphing of Malva in this season, it's just out there. They're like, and maybe we only see it because we've read the books and the books brought. There was not as much foreshadowing in the books with Malva, I don't believe.
Things with her developed much more quietly. But again, they had more space, right? They have less space here. So she speaks of her mother. She says, quote, my mother was not so spiritually inclined. She was hanged as a witch. I was very young. I hardly remember. Then I wrote, okay, so they don't buff here. But she sure does give him the look over her shoulder as she walks away. And he doesn't discourage her. I'm just going to say that. Back to the big house. It's the poked fire from the opening. Jamie is semi-threatening the wee boys who had absconded with Henri Christian. He's like, lots of fire and brimstone and troubled soul and sinners and witches and hell talk all this episode. Lots of it. Jamie tells them all. He has Henri Christian there in his basket. And he has this red hot poker from the fire. And he says, you must touch Henri Christian. And if you will not touch him, you must touch the red hot poker. It's like, well, that's a selection. I do not recognize it. I could not sing it or hum it to you, to which Summer says, thank goodness. But the very sweet music that's playing around that point must be Henri Christian's theme. And before he like has them do the thing, Jamie, one of the little boys asks, does he belong to God? Like, that's what Mr. McKenzie said. And Jamie's like, well, I would believe Mr. McKenzie. And Jamie says, whoever else he belongs to, I claim him as my own. So he belongs to me. And so they do the whole thing. They touch the baby and they all survive. A miracle of miracles. And so he's like, okay, now take some bread.
No one touched the poker.
I know. He's like, okay, take some bread and honey and skedaddle. But Germain remains. And Jamie implores upon him the importance of protecting his brother.
Mm-hmm. Shay Marsley and Fergus. Fergus is drinking again, and he's even more depressed. She talks now of how she and Joni and her mother suffered because of her mom putting up with someone who drank. And she's like, please, she's begging him now. Please tell me how I can help you. What's going on? She makes a good point. You can't protect anyone when you're drunk. Because he's like, I can't protect you. And she's like, what do you think you're doing now? You're not helping.
No, and you didn't feed the kids?
All of it, yes.
I'm like, she comes home, he's drunk, and the kids are all whining for food and saying they're hungry.
Yes.
And she's like, well, I'm really glad I took Henri Christian with me then, because... Yeah.
He drinks my milk, at least.
Right. At least I made sure they were fed.
She wants Fergus to see. She tells him she wants to see that she can provide, she can fight, and she can help protect them too. And he's not alone. They're not only reliant upon him. She tells him, and he's like, oh, but. And she's like, look, dude, you want some proof? Here you go. I killed Lionel. Mm-hmm. And then she ends it all with, quote, I was worried it would haunt me, but it doesn't.
No, it really doesn't. And then, but that had the opposite reaction that she shot that she thought it would have.
Look, she shot her shot.
Yeah. I'm just saying this made him more mad instead of less mad.
Yeah. He flips out and says he doesn't need a woman to protect him, but he does need a drink. So she pours something from a pitcher over his head. He's pissy and she tells him to leave and not to come back until he's acting like a man of the house. And she goes, I will have a whole man or none at all.
That's bookish.
Definitely bookish. Back at the big house, Jamie fills Claire in on what was going on. Jamie says, quote, we're his grandparents, meaning the talk of the town, talk of the fish folk, talk of a lot of the Protestants, right, about him being a spawn of the devil, blah, blah, blah. And Jamie's like, we're his grandparents. What does that say about us? And just him asking this triggers Claire to have an Arl flashback. And when he goes, is everything okay, Cessna? She doesn't tell him. That's one of the things, and I saw that kind of not battered. Like, it wasn't, people were not throwing this out there to be, you know, blatantly throwing it out there. But kind of, they have hinted about it. They've mentioned it, but it's not like a main topic of discussion that I've seen. But one of the problems, and to me, this is not a problem, but a lot of people are complaining, as we know, about Claire's use of ether, right? As an escape. What is absolutely a problem is that she refuses to let Jamie in. That is something that I've read, you know, actors saying or discussing, or actors mentioning, production mentioning, etc. And so when he asks her, like, she has plenty, I'm not blaming her, I'm just saying, it's harder, does not make the trauma go away, but to not let in the one person who is there who's supposed to be able to support you, even though they can't take it away, it further isolates herself. And the more you isolate yourself, the worse your trauma can develop, I guess, can be.
It's a cycle. Trauma is a cycle. You feel the things, you blame yourself for feeling the things, you try to find something to make you not feel the things, and then you feel bad about taking the things that made you not feel the things, but then you feel the things again, and then you're driven to do the same thing again, and then you're going to punish yourself for doing the thing. Like, it's a cycle that honestly doesn't end until you make a break.
Yes. And so he asks her, is everything okay or what's going on? And she's like, I'm fine. I need to go check on Tom. So there's some very freakish, and I think this would probably be some dissonance, or maybe just a little bit of dissonance. Dissonance, you need to have more than one sound. One sound alone does not equal dissonance, because dissonance by definition is two things that are like aurally clanging together. But the music definitely was ominous. Let's put it that way. So there's a very freakish music playing behind this. You can see that she is contemplating the ether, right? Because she goes down there and kind of looks around. But she sees Tom is awake. And she does check on him, and she gives him something to drink, and he's got a fever, so she helps with that. And she wants to check his hand. He asks her, by the way, why don't you ever wear a proper cap? There's a lot of your hair. There's a lot of it.
And she goes, a lot of it.
There is a lot of it. This is not awkward at all. And she's like, why are you got this buck up your butt? And he's like, because every pious woman should. Of course, it was St. Paul, right? His last line, quote, he's talking about why women should do this, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, he's quoting verse, I believe. And he's like, women should do this when they prophesy, blah, 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 blah. And the end of the line were, as if she were shaven, unquote. And I wrote, ha, 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 just wait.
Foreshadowing?
A little bit, maybe a bitzel.
Well, they have to be that way. And the reason they have to be that way is because bringing it up now, him bringing the cap up, honestly, to me, telegraphs that they are going to do the head something. Thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Quote. She talks to him about his hand. Quote. I want to see how this does overnight before I risk prophesying about it. And he This is when he says, you have a lot of hair. And she says, yep. And while they're chatting, she's basically showing him the physical therapy exercises on his hand. And she offers him some nibbles. Scary music plays again when she goes into the other room. And she's like, hey, baby girl, or boy, baby boy. She talks to Adso. And I love this little guy. You could totally hear him purring because he was. I mean, I guess they could have added it in later, but he seemed happy. So it was probably his purr. Who knows? She brings Tom something to eat. And he asks about, like, who was that in the kitchen? Like, who are you talking to? And she's like, oh, no, it's just a cat. He's not my familiar.
Right. I'm like, that didn't make it much better initially.
And he reminds her, like, this is the second time in one episode he's said, like, gone out of his way to mention, I'm educated. He reminds her that he's educated. He does not believe in foolish nonsense. And he says, I do not think you're a witch. He says, I do believe in them, but you are not one. And then he apologizes for his behavior. And he doesn't mean squabbling about ether. He means the fact that he was screaming in pain and not and not able to keep still. And this is a ginger, not the show. Although I'm sure the show actually would probably not disagree with me. The fact, and yes, he was a little bit in his cups. Fair enough. Okay. And he was in pain. So I still think the reason he said that at all, that feeling, even drunk or not, existed within him, that he felt he had to say something. That is the poison of toxic masculinity and the patriarchy, that men feel the need to perform for each other and in front of women to their own detriment, right? He should never have. Why would you apologize for reacting to pain the way a human acts for pain? You shouldn't.
Because he wasn't able to, but then he immediately says, well, but your man would have been that
way.
He's
apologizing for his dick is what is doing, is what you're saying.
He's like, I'm sorry, my dick is smaller.
Exactly. There we go. So then he brings up, he's like, you know, your husband has lots of flogging scars. And she's like, yeah. And he's like, he says he only knows why some of them are there. The ones he got at Ardsmuir. And he goes, yeah, there's an old man who had some tartan and Jamie got in trouble and Jamie claimed it was his. And he says, quote, an act of extraordinary courage, incomprehensible. So he doesn't understand why Jamie would do it. Not the what, but the why. And he's like, I'm not one of his men. And Claire says, wouldn't you do the same for a stranger? An act of kindness? And he basically says, okay, good night, Mistress Fraser.
Yeah, I'm like, I guess we're done here.
So Jamie's lying there in bed. When she comes in the room, it's like they purposely like posed Sam. He's just laying there. Like, he's not up to his neck in covers. He's just, there's like a light on, or I guess a candle, not a
Doesn't
light.
Doesn't he have like one hand like over his head?
Yes,
like,
that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And his naked booby chest. I mean.
Yeah, you know he heard her coming up the stairs and he's
something.
Like, okay.
Oh, no. Come on, I'm like, lady. Dang. He's Check all just lying there in the bed, posed, being all sexy. Gracious. Claire asks point blank, is Tom afraid of women or afraid of sinning? He's uncomfortable with me just touching him at all, like even on his hand. And then Jamie's like, well, that was me too. You know, it took me years after Ardsmuir. So he tells her the tale. He does not go all the way there, although I think it's implied. He tells her the tale of love and
at the time he was in jail. We'll make it rhyme and you can sing
no,
it to the tune
Summer.
Of.
Summer, stop it.
Tell me the tale of the time you're in jail.
Summer, stop. He tells the tale of self-love and the love of others.
In jail.
At Ardsmuir.
Oh, there you go. Sing me the tale of self-love in a jail.
In a place called Ardsmuir.
Ardsmuir. There you go. We're done. We just made millions.
Claire asks about Malva.
and how she fits into all of this. She's like, isn't she like, wasn't she 18? Like, she's trying to find like when they moved, when did he have his wife? Was she born here? Where was she raised? All that. So this episode, one of the points of this episode was we got it from several people. Well, now we're getting it from Jamie and Claire, or instigated through Claire, answered, provided by Jamie. Tom has given us a little bit, right? He hasn't mentioned his wife, but he's intimated some things.
No, but we know things from people, from other people. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just saying we're getting a lot of information here about Malva's mom, about Alan, about his ex-wife, or sorry, his former wife. In this conversation, Claire says something to the effect of like, wouldn't she be 18? She's 18. Like how, she didn't say this exactly, but these are my words. How did he have time to make her? Like, how does the timeline line up where she was born sometime or conceived before Ardsmuir? And then Tom goes away, and then Tom gets out and is sent to the colonies, and then his wife and kids are brought up. Like, she's trying to, and believe me, dear Claire, the readers don't understand either. I mean, we have a little bit better idea, but it's not a perfect idea. So she's trying to make all this, like, make sense time-wise. Good going, because a lot of people are. And right toward the end of this, we have some other love theme. I didn't hear any Ridge theme tonight, which is, I guess, appropriate because it wasn't a very happy episode. So I guess that makes sense. Flash to Malva gathering rushes. Again with Ian. Commence the flirting. Now she says her words are, quote, sometimes I think people make mistakes, do the wrong thing, but perhaps for the right reasons, unquote. Have we not said there's telegraphing all throughout these episodes?
I said Malva and Ian are getting a little cozy and a bit and get to know each other-y. Huh.
Sure, Malva, sure. And Ian lets out that this whole thing is like, seriously, dude? He lets out that he has some of his own land to farm. And no, he doesn't have to pay rent for it. Red flag, Ian. Red flag.
He hasn't been doing anything with it either.
Yes, but that's not the point. The point is, he offers that he's got his own property. And she asks about how much money he has to give. So she's trying to get more information. Now, he offered it, but she's trying to get more information. And she touches his face and asks about his tattoos. And I swear to you, if they had not pulled away, they were about to kiss. It was too close. A week later, Tom comes back for his checkup. He's doing well. And she tells him about how she reads to help her sleep, because he sees like some books stacked up. She says, do you read novels? And he's like, well, I did it until after Ardsmuir. He's like, my wife read them. But when we were in Ardsmuir, the stories that Jamie told had, you know, basically committed to memory that he told everyone, it drew people together. And so it was after I saw the benefit of this in certain times, like when you're in prison, that I could see the benefit of sometimes reading novels of fiction.
but only once it was read aloud to him, because it made me kind of chuckle, because I was like, well, he's been told it's lazy and that's a sin and you shouldn't be reading things that aren't important, and it's fiction, so it's something that, you know, will keep your mind too idle, and you should be working. But then he's like, but then once Jamie read aloud to me in prison at night, you know, our bedtime story every night, I've changed my mind about fiction. It brings people together, just like Outlander.
So she goes, I can drop this off to you. She offers to lend it to him, and he says, I'll pick it up in a few days.
I feel like she should have given him a different book for his first fiction book.
It was just the book that was on top. And so she was like, you can take it if you want. And he's like, oh, by the way, Richard Brown came by this morning, and he was chatting, and he offered his protection, the protection of his committee of safety. Claire says, I hope you refused him.
No, thanks.
He is not to be trusted. And did you see how it ended? I think Jamie comes in right then. Tom has nothing else to say. He takes his leave. He never says what he told or how he responded to Brown. Now, I will say this without doing my best not to spoil. Again, we don't know what they're going to keep in the series, right? Or how they're going to adapt it, or if they're going to adapt it. If it goes the way it goes in the books,
later down the road, right? This thing right here that they just did, actually, if Tom said that he would take Brown's protection, or even is just a little bit getting more trusting of Brown, it would actually go quite far to help accelerate what may happen later on a little more. Because we only have 8 episodes and we're almost halfway done, right? So yeah, that's saying a lot without saying anything, because I know if you don't know the story, that means gobbledygook to you. But if you know the books, then you're catching what I'm throwing some?
Yes.
Specifically between Brown and Christy. Okay.
Yes. But you know, if I try to explain it, it absolutely includes spoilers. So I'm trying to not.
Got it. Okay. So that's why you're sticking to yes and no answer.
Yes.
So Tom has nothing else to say, as I said. And so I'm wondering, what did he tell him? And we may not know. I believe we will find out later, because that's pretty important. And that's a big, it's a red flag, even though, so Tom doesn't know the history, right? And she has not told him about her trauma. But to her, it's absolutely a red flag, anything about the Browns. But to Tom, he's just new to town, and he's not going out of his way to make enemies on purpose everywhere. And then not Jamie, it was more patience. Jamie, later on, or maybe the same point, again outside, Malva has a lot of outdoor chores. Jamie comes up upon Malva.
I hated this.
First I wrote, I wonder if she'll flirt with him. So she's looking for mushrooms. And he is fair enough. He's just making small talk. And he says something like, you know what? I bet you are just going to be, you're going to have your pick of the dozen. You're going to find somebody to sweep it off your feet pretty soon. And she says, I don't want to get married that soon. Thanks. And I was just like, Jamie, shut the F up.
Thank you. I felt like this. I know he's being nice, but it's more telegraphing for me. No, you don't. And did you notice her? She looked like she had a little bit of a bulgy apron.
Stop your front door. I have to go watch it again after we're done here. No.
I'm just saying, it just looked a little fuller.
Okay, I'll have to go look at it. Darn you. Okay, so of course he's not flirting, but to her it's flirting, right? So he says, oh, sorry, sorry, lass. I didn't mean to imply anything. You can do what you want, blah, 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 blah. I'm just teasing. No, Jamie, you don't understand. You don't tease with teenage girls.
No.
He's like, please. This is even worse. He should have stopped right there and said, okay, well, have a good day. So he continues and says, well, please let me take you up to the Green Spring and show you all the wood ears. I found a whole bunch. So it's just not great. So as they walk, it doesn't cut off, right? So as they walk, just like with Ian, walk and talk, they talk and walk, or walk and talk. So they have chit chat.
Jamie is using this as a fact-finding mission, as well as be nice to our new people.
He is absolutely trying to get information, because this is related to what he and Claire discussed the night before, or the last time we saw them together. So we find out that Alan was brought up in Edinburgh, and yes, they have the same mother, and Malva was also brought up in Scotland, so they were not raised in the colonies. So that's the information that they share. So think about it this way, without spoiling Summer. Dear listener, a man in his 50s who has all the power in the world over her, on the rich, he is the man. And a new family, still building their home and all of this stuff, who is there because of the generosity of this man. So again, power imbalance, right? She is a young teenager, unmarried. So as we said, they technically probably shouldn't be out chit-chatting it up with nobody around. If this were another dude, meaning a younger dude her age, they would have needed a chaperone, or it would have had to have been, formalized so that they could spend time together or whatever. Maybe not so much in the backcountry, but you know what I'm getting at. So while you are 100% right, Jamie's goal of getting this information was related to what he and Claire had already talked about, right? That's his goal. That's his only thing. He is not thinking outside the box. For a very smart man, he's kind of stupid right now.
Thank you. He was stupid, and it felt like he should have known better, because he is a man of the time and he knows the rules.
Correct. Claire can get away with this. Jamie, you have no excuse. And so that's the Jamie side, right? That's his intent. And that's how he's trying to come across as easy breezy, beautiful color girl, sorry, cover girl, you know, just trying to be the nice, not a Laird, but I just say Laird, the nice big honcho dude, whatever. He's trying to be helpful, right? He's showing her where these mushrooms are because she's collecting them. So he's literally helping her He's helping her in a very practical way. But also the subterfuge, because it's not being sneaky. He's asking very normal questions like getting to know people, right? It's kind of a surfacey level conversation, but he has points or reasons for asking very specific questions. That's him. What does she take from this? Without spoiling, without even trying to make anything up or whatever, what would a teenage girl new with this power imbalance, the status imbalance, new, quote unquote, you know, like fresh off the boat kind of girl who is there just trying to get her, you know, her land legs basically in this new setting, in a new country.
Well, she's a teenage girl. Any boy or male figure that shows interest or is nice to them immediately becomes, oh, they must like me.
Exactly. And that can develop into an infatuation. I'm not saying she's infatuated with him, but she's definitely intrigued by him. And she sees hit. She sees everything he's doing because she doesn't know the conversation that he's had with her father, that he's had with his wife, right? She doesn't know that and she doesn't need to. But we talked about what Jamie's, like 100% of what Jamie, we get it. We know why Jamie's asking those questions. Very light, you know, like surface questions, like, you know, very superficial questions.
Absolutely.
How does she take it? 100% as interest. 100% as interest. And maybe willingness. We'll have to see. Fast forward to Shea Christie. Tom is home alone, as far as like we can tell, and he's reading. And the words that the camera like bumps up to, like, you know, highlights, it's like...
All of the misspelled F words.
Exactly. Like lust, hunger, this and that. Yeah, exactly. And he's like, oh.
I saw the word spelled three different ways.
Oh, see, I miss all that. Apparently I didn't see as well.
There was an F-U-C-H, F-U-C-K. Like it was...
Oh, so it wasn't just like a love scene. It was straight up language. Okay.
Well, it was the thing. I don't believe it was a lust scene. It was a dude. If I read as much of the words as I could when it was going on the screen, it was talking about a guy who liked F-U-C-H-ing.
F-U-C-H-ing.
And he's lustful. That's how it was spelled.
P-H-U-C.
P-H-U-C. No, but the book is spelled F-U-C-H. And F-U-C-H-S.
Fuchs.
I'm just saying. And I thought to myself, he should have picked a different book for his first novel.
Yes. And so he shuts the book and is like, okay, we're done with that. Next day or sometime later, it is quarter day. Lizzie finally makes an appearance. She's doing something with the something and, oh, I guess handing out the ale.
She's passing out drinks.
And the boys are offering to help. And she's like, yeah, you can help getting me some ale, please. Inside, Fergus is still drinking. And the bugs notice it.
That wasn't the bugs.
Oh, it wasn't the bugs.
Those were fisher people.
I totally went off on the bugs. I'm so sorry, bugs, because I have a whole bunch of...
No, those were fisher people.
I have a whole bunch of capital letters later on. So Fergus is still drinking, and an older couple, a fisher folk couple, notice it. And also, while they're still inside, Fergus isn't liking that Marshley is there laughing and chatting it up with Evan Lindsay.
But she's only chatting him up because he helped make that giant spinning wheel that she loves. But she was kind of flirty. She was a little flirty. And so was he.
Bree asks about setting up Evan. I think she's asking Roger, right? Yeah. And she's asking, well, why don't we think about setting up Evan Lindsay with Lizzie? And Roger's like, oh my goodness, you're blind, aren't you? If he can get between her and the twins, sure. More telegraphing people.
Yeah, he was like, you're an idiot. You don't pay attention to anything.
There's a lot of idiots on the ridge this episode.
I know. Idiots and dicks.
Oh, good grief. So I said more telegraphing. Drunk Fergus, now I wrote, confronts the bugs. So this older couple, fisher folk couple, they're walking out and Fergus walks out and he confronts them. And he's like, if you have something to say, say it to my face. And they go there.
They were like, oh, yeah, allow me to say it to your face.
And they're like, fine, your son is grotesque. Fergus straight up throws alcohol in the woman's face. And I was like, yeah. Go Fergus.
No, not only that, She's like, yes, we think your son is grotesque, but I don't care about your missing hand. You're a drunk. He is a drunk, and he did need to hear it from somebody other than Marsley.
I was more upset about the grotesque part than the drunk part.
But yes, dude, then she had to nail it all, drive it all home by saying that he was grotesque. And I'm like, all she had to do was say nothing.
Or just call him a drunk. That's it.
Yeah.
But yes, he throws alcohol in her face and then he punches the person who is not Mr. Bug.
Yeah, that was not Mr. Bug. You're bad at faces.
Apparently, we don't see them that much. That's why. Lizzie says, I'm wrong again. Lizzie said, okay, so Claire and Jamie come out and say, hey, what's going on? What just happened? And Lizzie said, it's mostly Mrs. Bug, but actually is the woman who is not Mrs. Bug. And Alan stands up for the bugs, not bugs, saying, well, he did throw the woman.
He did call the son grotesque.
Exactly. And then Tom Christie is being reasonable. He stands up for the Frasers and the bugs F off. The bugs, not bugs, F off. So now, this is so wrong. I wrote in all caps. So now we know where the bugs stand. No, Ginger, they're not the bugs.
Not the bugs.
Okay, fast forward or next scene in the church. Roger is giving another sermon. He about Germain and Moses, basically.
I was going to say, it was really pointed. It was a pointed sermon.
I don't know if this is later on. I'm believing it's simultaneous because we have his sermon, his voiceover, over the next few scenes. So as he's giving his sermon, we see that Claire had stayed home. Tom Christie has returned the book and they're now passing notes. The note that he wrote so nicely, like what the handwriting, goodness, is this is filth. I thought better of you. Did you read the note?
No, I didn't see the note. Me no, either. I absolutely did
Until
not
I
see
had
the
to
note.
Pause it. I was like, that's amazing. I cackled.
We knew Claire was going to read a book like that because she liked that pirate one that was in the break room.
But I'm pretty sure she knew the story of Tom Jones and knowing Tom Christie, that it was not the right Tom book for him.
Tom book. Yes, exactly.
And Tom, once his hand is better, because now it's better, he absolutely began whipping Malva again. Yep.
It was all part of this montage.
Exactly. And the camera then goes on Alan. Now, this is probably, if you're a reader, excuse me, a non-reader, if you have not read the books, to me, probably the most, I mean, surface level, it's easy to understand. Or surface level, it's not confusing. But if you're thinking about like some things have deeper meanings, to me, this would be one of probably the most confusing things in the episode or in the storyline. Why Alan was like bawling for his sister. As a brother with his sister being beaten or whipped, whatever, it makes sense, right? You're sad that person is in pain or is suffering. So that, again, that surface level, that makes sense. But like, why does production need to go out of their way to show us that he's that affected by it, right? If it's normal, why do we need to see it so stand out so much? So always think about why they show us what they show us. So to me, that was probably one of the scenes that is the easiest to look over in the entire episode. Don't forget that he had a really bad reaction to her. And not just his reaction, he has to be quiet about it, right? He has to hide his reaction from his father, at least his father. Marsley is... He can't stand the sound of her being whipped. Marsley is spinning away. She's loving her thing. Fergus is contemplating something. By now, I think the sermon is done. So we see Fergus. He's thinking about something, and Jamie luckily comes upon him. And he's come home from hunting, I think fishing, and he sees him, and he's like, he doesn't say it, but he's thinking like, oh, there's a Fergus, and he sees him walking down the hill.
Just walking away from home.
And he decides to follow him. And he follows him and watches him all the way up until he sees him slice his arm open. And then he's like, and Jamie like yells at him, Fergus! And like drops his stuff and runs to him. And he fights him. And he holds the wound like away. He's like, don't sorry, Jamie grabs him, holds the wound because he knows from Claire, you need to put pressure on a wound, and he knocks him to the ground. And Fergus says, let me die. This is the only way. This is for them. Marsley can marry again and find a man who can provide for her and the children. I cannot protect them.
By that reckoning, though, he never could. And she still chose him.
And he knows that. But that's what it's like everything piling up. It's just so he can't see. Yeah, it's too much. It was too much before the baby came.
He's depressed and feeling bad for himself. And he feels like everything he's done is a failure.
And so Jamie makes a very good point. And I'm not sure if it's in the books. And if it is, I don't remember. So Fergus calls himself useless, right? Now, using his own words, Jamie says that Fergus is the only one who can show Henri Christian what a, quote, useless man can achieve and how proud he can make his father, unquote. So I don't remember that sentiment being expressed. It's possible it was there, and I just don't remember it, but I don't remember that. He says, don't you understand? In French, he says, do you understand, my child, my son? Mm-hmm. And Fergus answers, I'm not who I once was. And Jamie says, don't worry, we will help you. Yeah. And then they go later on, the next scene, they go to chez eux and Marsley greets him. So by the time they get there, Marsley knows what has gone. Like, she's been prepared. Marsley greets him with Henri Christian. And he says, I'm sorry. Never again.
We'll see if it sticks this time.
Right. Just in time for the drama. Some redcoats are back at the big house. MacDonald has brought the guns. Bird requested. And he also shows Jamie and Claire, or Jamie at least, a newspaper that outlines or has an article about the Boston Tea Party. Now, this makes me want, because I think I said either in somewhere online, like in some chat we were having, or maybe in our live or in an episode. I forget where, but I said it somewhere. I think I just said, I literally recently, in the last few days, I said somewhere that like Bobby Higgins is gone. Like, we're not going to get him at all. And that's, we may not. But if you know the story in the books, and this is not a, I don't think it's worth, because again, they don't know the character. It's going to be meaningless, I believe. So them having an article that mentions the Boston Tea Party, again, this article could be 6 months old, right? It doesn't mean it just happened. But it made me wonder for the first time if we actually might get Bobby Higgins. Because Bobby, do you remember who Bobby Higgins was? Not the character, but what happened to him before we met him?
Yes. He worked for Lord John. He used to be a soldier, but he had a scar on his face because he accidentally killed one of his own people because of friendly fire.
So that's why I said it made me wonder if we might get Bobby. Because in the story, in the books, not the name of the guy, Bobby Higgins, but and maybe not even the facial brand, but true to history, the Boston Tea Party was, it involved soldiers and colonists, right? And they don't, there's a lot of, not contemplation, a lot of consideration, a lot of whatever about who actually shot first or why the first shot was fired. But yes, at the end of it, there were several colonists, I believe several people died, but there's at least one officer who did shoot, maybe more, I don't know. But they claimed that they believed they heard that someone, one of their people say fire, basically. In real life, those soldiers were tried. I believe none were hanged, none went to prison. But, and I don't know from history if anyone was branded. It was not an uncommon practice back then. But in the book, at least one of them, one of the soldiers whose guns went off at the Boston Tea Party was Bobby Higgins. And he was tried and he was found semi-guilty, whatever, guilty enough to have a brand, but he wasn't imprisoned or hanged. So yeah, he had a brand on his face, the letter M on one of his cheeks, I believe. And so he was a soldier, and then he was basically then not a soldier, but then like he has no job. He has no way to making money. And that's, yes, in the book, he worked for Lord John, was kind of like his messenger, his lackey, like his jack of all trades kind of thing. Like he kind of did errands for Lord John. So I've been what I thought for sure we're not going to get Bobby Higgins because like why? Lord John's gone, blah, 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 whatever. However, if they're saying that
they gave us Amy McCallum, I'm just saying.
I know that, but we don't necessarily need Bobby Higgins. It could be somebody, or we could get Bobby Higgins who is not a Brit. I mean, it's just they could go around it many, many ways. And they still may do that, or may not have him. But I'm just saying, because they mentioned the Tea Party, I was like, oh, we may get Bobby Higgins. That's fascinating. And we may get him before the end of the season, which may then introduce the fact that Lord John is actually back. Because we've seen him in a scene, in some party scene, right? So we know that he's back this season. Yes. So what does this all mean for the people on the Ridge? Meaning the announcement or the news of the Tea Party. Claire says that it's starting. It's getting closer. And she says the storm and the war are almost here.
I feel like the guns being brought to them for the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Says we're going to the Indians next week. What do you think?
Oh, good. I almost like good eyeballs, but you're not hearing anything. Sorry, you're not seeing anything. You're hearing something.
I saw the guns and they talked about the Indians.
All the senses, good senses. Is that better? Absolutely. Yeah, we'll have to see what happens in the next one.
And that was episode 603. Join us next time when we will be discussing episode 604. Please join us on our Facebook group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Laura D.
And if you're interested in any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.